Well, in 1888, one morning, a man named Alfred opened a newspaper only to find that he was reading about his own death. There was a careless reporter who had confused Alfred with his brother, and his brother had died. And they wrote the obituary, but they wrote about Alfred. Now, it's one thing to wake up and read your own obituary, and it's another thing to find out what actually people were saying about you after you died. One French newspaper had the headline, "The Merchant of Death is Dead." That was the headline. Well, you see, Alfred and his family owned some factories that made armaments for war. He himself was a brilliant chemist, engineer, and inventor. He held over 350 patents, one of which he was most famous for was dynamite. And his family had got very wealthy as a result. And to the general public, he was the dynamite king. And his fortune was great. But in all these obituaries, there was no mention of what really interested him the most. And that was his ideas for peace for mankind and his efforts to break down the barriers between peoples. That's what he was really interested in. But he realized, I'm going to be remembered as the merchant of death. So he determined right then and there that he wanted to do something to make sure that the world recognized his true values that he held. And he decided this could be accomplished best by the way that he disposed of his wealth. So a few years later, in 1896, in fact, 8 years later, he died of a cerebral hemorrhage. And when his will was read, they discovered that he had left virtually his entire fortune to a trust fund for awards that would be given in advancements in physics and medicine, economics, literature, chemistry, and the most prestigious award would be given for the person who significantly contributed to the cause of world peace. You probably know who this is by now. It was Alfred Nobel. And he was the one who originated the Nobel Peace Prize. Now, knowing what we know, someday Alfred Nobel will be resurrected, and it'll probably be very pleasing to him that millions of people remember him now for the Nobel Peace Prize instead of being the merchant of death. But that's how he was going to be remembered. Now, let's fast forward a little over 30 years ago. One of the widows in the Akron, Ohio congregation died. I believe she was somewhere in her late 60s. And she was one of those who was like the matriarch, one of the matriarchs of the congregation. Seems like many congregations have just a highly respected, esteemed older woman or two or three or maybe many. They're just rock-solid figures in the congregation. And at the viewing the night before the funeral, the family handed out 3x5 index cards to everybody who came, and they just asked if they would write down a memory or two of her. They intended to keep those memories. They weren't going to do anything with them. They just wanted to see what people would say. And toward the end of the evening, I had a chance to get that stack of cards and sit down and read them. And I asked them, can I read these tomorrow? Can I read some of these? They were not planning a eulogy, but just reading those cards sort of became her eulogy. There were a lot of wonderful comments. Some were very general. Some recounted specific things. But the card that I saved for the last and ended that little section on was written by a 15-year-old teenager in the congregation. And that girl wrote three words. She wrote, "Mary was cool." Mary was cool. Now, when I read it at the funeral the next day, everybody had the same reaction. They laughed. And yet, at the same time, they realized, I think, that that was one of the highest compliments that she could get for a young person to put in young person language just a summary of what they thought about her. And it said a lot. I mean, you have to be special to earn that kind of recognition from a 15-year-old when you're in your 60s. I have often thought that when Mary's resurrected and she hears about that, she's probably going to toss her head back and laugh really heartily like she did, and will probably be appreciating the way that she was remembered. So my question for all of you is, what will you be remembered for? What will you be remembered for? I thought about distributing 3x5 cards today. That might be a little unwieldy. And asking you to write down what you think people might write about you in your obituary or at your funeral. And some of us in the audience are old enough to start thinking about that. But I decided not to do that because we have a lot of young people here today, and I don't want you to be thinking about what they're going to write at your funeral. And you don't want to be doing that anyway. But I do want you to consider, as you're the ones who are my target audience today primarily, I want you to consider this question. No cards, but consider the question and think about something that is not what will they say about me, but something related to that very closely. Something that's more relevant to your life now. What do people say about me? What do people say about me? And does it matter? And should it matter? What do people say about me? What does it matter? Does it matter? Should it matter? If you take those questions and the answers very seriously, they can actually shape your life. If you take those questions and answers seriously, they can shape your life and they can help make you a better person. Let's start with the last two questions. Does it matter what anyone thinks about you, or should it matter? Simple answer is yes. Now, sometimes people say, well, I don't care what people think about me. There is a reason why we shouldn't care. It matters because your life, everybody's life, impacts other people. Your life does impact other people. Our spheres of influence may be larger, or they may be smaller, but our spheres of influence do impact other people. And other people impact you. Sometimes we hear statements like, well, every person needs a role model. And that's true, but sometimes we miss the point that every person is a role model. Every person is a role model. May not be the best one, but every person sets an example and nobody can escape it. Every life is a model of some way to live. And as soon as you see other people, you're seeing an example. And as soon as other people see you, they're seeing an example. People watch people. We see people. Now, I'm not talking about spying on anybody. I'm just saying that's just life. We watch each other. We watch people. We see the lives of others unfold. We see others. Others see us. And what we see in others influences us sometimes to emulate them or sometimes to say, no, that's not what I want to do or be like. We do have influence. And really what we're talking about, the most important impact of that is not what people are going to say in an obituary or what they're going to write on the 3x5 card when we're gone. The most important impact is how it affects people right now. How your life affects others as we go through life, as we are living. You know, for all of you teens and young adults, everybody is observing you. Everybody. We are watching you, how you handle your first crush, your first romance. It always comes. We see how you study, how you talk, how you work, how you serve. We watch you grow. That's what life is. We watch you grow. So how important is it? How important is it to your life how you are living and modeling. Well, let me give you an example. Here's just one real-life example of many. Let's say Mr. Scott Lord up in Maryland calls Mr. Burnett or Mr. Black or Mr. Traybig and says, hey, this person from your congregation has applied to be a counselor at camp. You know what the next question is? Should I accept them? They've applied to be a counselor at camp. Should I accept them? And in other words, the pastor on this end who gets the phone call immediately starts thinking, okay, what am I going to say? And they start thinking, what is their reputation? What is their reputation? Now, immediately, Mr. Barnett or Mr. Traybridge or Mr. Black's, whoever is called, their reputation is on the line because they are being depended on to give an accurate assessment and to make a very accurate recommendation. And so they start immediately considering this person will be leading and overseeing and be responsible for the lives of a number of children of other people. Do I entrust them with that responsibility? You know what they're going to be evaluating that on? It's not going to be on, well, I think 10 years from now, they may be pretty responsible. They're looking at current and past reputation. What have I seen? What have they modeled that tells me that I think they could do this? So, yeah, it matters. It matters to you. It matters to others. As a parent who's been through that, or a grandparent, every parent wants to know that when I drop my child off at the door of summer camp, that whoever's looking after them is going to be responsible. And that responsibility will have been shown in example. Most important, though, it matters to God. That's the big thing. It matters to God. God is intently interested in your life. He's intently interested in the lives of all of us here. And our young people, he's intently interested in your life. He's called us, I think you all understand this, he's called us to prepare us for something bigger in life than what's going on around us here. Something that's going to come someday where he wants us to be leaders and rulers and overseers and have responsibilities with Jesus Christ in his kingdom to help turn around the way of the world today. But what he's looking at, what he's watching is how are we living now? How are we living now? How are those qualities being developed in our lives now? And also he's watching because he knows, and we know, that the way we live does influence others. It can really help others. It can encourage others, or it can hurt others. How we live, the example we set, how what people say about us is important. It matters to God that you are someone whose life honors him and sets an example of living his way and thus has a good influence on others. So, whether we're older or whether we're younger, male, female, or peers with one another, people see us. We may not like it. It may make us uncomfortable, but it's life. That's what happens. And we will have people say things. So what do you want people to say? What do you want people to say about you? If you want God to say, hey, well done, good and faithful servant. If you want your parents to say, as the Father said of Jesus Christ, this is my beloved son whom I'm well pleased, or my beloved daughter whom I'm well pleased. If you want that, if you want your peers to see you as a positive influence, I want you to be pointed today towards someone that you can follow, someone that you can emulate and think about their example. There's a story in the Bible. That's actually not a story. We can piece together a story based on things that are said about this person to give us some things to think about. Things to think about in terms of example and the importance of being what God wants us to be and how it impacts people. Things that were said about this person, or maybe said and written. This person offers a very interesting story, and it's an example that a lot of young people can relate to, because he was a third generation Christian. He grew up, you might say, in the churches, to use the vernacular. The church wasn't in the same form as this day, but he grew up in a family that carried on the way of following God. He was called as a young person fairly early in life. We see his life, some probably 20 years later, is about the last we hear from him. But he grew and matured and developed a reputation. It wasn't written on a 3x5 card. It's written in here. And it's a really great story, and it has lessons for young and old. He was an outstanding model. Not a model of a perfect person. He was sort of an ordinary person in many respects. But he was an outstanding model of someone who was continually maturing and growing. His name is Timothy. Be turning to 2 Timothy, if you will. I'll give you a little background on him. Now, most of this sermon is simply going to be talking about Timothy's life. I'm going to point out a few things that would be lessons for us today, but the most powerful lessons are going to be the ones that you collect from your listening and reading this. I'll try to point out some things, but really the benefit of this and the expectation that I have in this message is that you will draw lessons for you. That you will see some things in his life that you will look at and say, okay, I'm going to try to follow that. Because as I follow that, it's going to influence other people. So if you want a subtitle, the title of the sermon could be, what did they say about me? Or what will they say about me after going crazy? But the subtitle could be Timothy, the model and me. The model and me. And it's for all ages, actually. But Timothy is a teenager when we meet him. And he's a male, but that's okay. What we're going to be looking at are character issues that apply to male and female alike. So whether you're a young man or a young woman here, it's the character issues that you can draw. Timothy was the son of a mixed marriage. His father was Greek. His mother was Jewish. From the time that he was a child, his mother Eunice and his grandmother Lois taught him, as you can read here in 2 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 5, they taught him how to live. Paul wrote to him, "When I call to remembrance the genuine faith that is in you, which dwelt first in your grandmother Lois and your mother Eunice," right there we are told how powerful example and teaching is. One generation taught the next generation, it taught the next generation, and they all combined, and it was influencing the examples, the teachings, what ends up as faith in one person's life had a source of someone prior setting an example and teaching this. And he said, "I'm persuaded it's in you also." In chapter 3, in verse 15, it says, "From childhood you have known the Holy Scriptures." So this is someone whose parents and grandparents was teaching them very carefully. They brought him up in their faith, and they too were great examples. Now, Timothy was a native of a town called Lystra, L-Y-S-T-R-A. Those days it was in the region of Lycaonia and the Roman province of Galatia, which today is modern Turkey. Now, Timothy had his mother and grandmother as great models. He had several models in his life, but he also had a mentor. Not early on, but later he had a mentor. Now, a mentor is someone that you see. But a mentor is not only someone you see, but someone who takes you under their wing and purposefully begins to instruct and give advice and teaching And his mentor turned out to be the Apostle Paul. And one of Paul's expectations of Timothy is the same one that I'm putting before all of you young people today. And that is to take on the mantle of responsibility to be a positive, godly model to other people. To other people. To be example conscious. To be aware that, yes, I have to live my own life, but my life will affect other people. And to take that on as a challenge that can really make you a better person. Apparently, Timothy met Paul when Paul was on his first journey. Let's go to Acts chapter 16. Acts 16, and we'll start in verse 1. Then he, Paul, came to Derbe and Lystra. And behold, a certain disciple was there named Timothy, the son of a certain Jewish woman who believed, but his father was Greek. So he grew up in a house where there were differences of religion, different backgrounds. Verse 2. He was well spoken of by the brethren who were at Lystra and Iconium. Now it's probable that about this time Timothy was around 18 years old. But already he had a reputation. That's a pretty interesting thing to say, isn't it? He was well spoken of. Well spoken of. The members there in the churches, they all had good things to say about Timothy. Because people noticed. They liked him. They recognized him as a fine young man. He was well spoken of, it also says, by the brethren. Not himself. You know, there's a proverb, Proverbs 27:2 says, let another man praise you, not your own lips, not your own mouth. Let other people praise you. You don't want to be known in life where somebody would write down on the 3x5 card, he or she was so full of himself or herself, they were always, all they could talk about was themselves. That wasn't Timothy. But he was well spoken of. And he had a good reputation. Now, Lystra and Iconium were at least 15 miles apart. Two towns, about 15 miles apart. Yet Timothy was well spoken of in both groups. Back then, when you had to walk, how long does it take you to walk 15 miles? It would be a good, at minimum, a good long half day's journey. I'd say today, that'd be like 4-hour drive between like East Texas and Houston, or Dallas and San Antonio is about 5. But I mean, it'd be today like somebody saying, hey, they had a reputation where the folks in Houston and East Texas, they knew him. And he had a good reputation there. Paul must have seen something in Timothy because he decided that he wanted to take him under his wing. Now, Paul is much older, and, you know, but he probably needed an assistant of some kind. So in verse 3, it says, Paul wanted to have him go on with him. And he was going to put him in a mentoring situation. Now, it says a bit about Timothy because Timothy had to say yes. Timothy had to agree to this. That Timothy was willing to leave behind. He was willing to leave behind his family. I don't know what plans or ambitions that he might have had, but an opportunity arose for Timothy, and he made a decision to go with Paul. And this was not an easy road to go. You know, you read in chapter 14, wasn't too long before this, in chapter 14 and verse 19, earlier in this trip that Paul was on, says the Jews from Antioch and Iconium came there, and having persuaded the multitudes, they stoned Paul and dragged him out of the city, supposing him to be dead. However, when the disciples gathered around him, he rose up and went to the next city. And the next day he departed with Barnabas to Derbe. And then in chapter 16, what we just read, when he came to Derbe, listen, so this was just before. He stoned and left dead. And he asked somebody, hey, you want to go with me? You like adventure? You want to see the world? Maybe get stoned on the way? Not that kind of stone. No, I mean, Timothy must have known that to go with Paul, there might be some hardships here. And am I willing to stand up and go with someone because I believe what he's doing is the right thing? Well, he did. And over time, they developed a very close relationship. I won't turn to these places, but Paul referred to Timothy three times with very deep feelings, calling him my beloved and faithful son in the Lord, and my true son in the faith, and my beloved son. It's speculated with some fair degree of validity that Timothy's father had probably died sometime before. Don't know when, but Paul seems to have been a father figure to this young man. So back in chapter 16, verse 3, now we have a bit of a problem. Paul wanted him to go on with him, and he took him and circumcised him because of the Jews who were in that region. For they all knew that his father was Greek. Now there's a bit of a challenge, because under Jewish law, the son took the religion of the mother. The mother had to be Jewish for the son to be considered Jewish. So to the Jews, he would have been considered Jewish, even though his father was Greek. And therefore, he should have been circumcised on the eighth day after his birth. But under Greek law, the father is the head of the house, and apparently his father did not allow him to be circumcised. That doesn't mean that his father was a bad person, but to the Greeks, they were generally appalled at the idea of circumcision. That was a Jewish thing. So it seems that he was content with letting his wife raise Timothy in the Jewish faith, but he stopped short of allowing him to be circumcised. Now, 18 years later, we have a situation. Just the chapter before, chapter 15, there had been a big ministerial conference to settle a doctrinal question of do you have to be circumcised to be saved? And the decision was no, you don't have to be. And now, in the very next chapter, Paul is saying Timothy needs to be. Why? Was Paul in disagreement with the decision of Acts 15? No, not at all. No, it wasn't that. It was one of those matters that is a hard judgment. What is best for the work that we are called to do? To go on. If we're going to do our job, what is best? Paul knew when we go into new areas with the gospel, and go to the synagogues to take an uncircumcised Jewish boy in there would be a slap in the face to all the other Jews that were there. They would not understand it. They would not welcome Paul or Timothy. They would never have even a chance to hear the truth that Paul was bringing to them, because they would be rejected out of hand to begin with. Now, that really wasn't the Jews' fault, because they didn't know the truth about Acts 15. But this would be a stumbling block to them to receive the truth before you could even start. So Paul wanted Timothy to be circumcised so that they could work together. And it says, Paul took him and circumcised him. Now, I don't think that this is something that Paul forced on Timothy. Timothy's a grown man. It had to be something that Timothy agreed to do, but they probably talked it over. Paul probably reasoned with him. Timothy, here's the situation. Here's what is needed. Are you good? This raises an important issue to consider about the example of others. The example that it sets for us. It would have been easy for Timothy to make it all about himself. He could have said, well, hey, That's their problem. Sometimes we can think that way. That's their problem. They shouldn't think like that. Why should I have to concede something just to put up with their ignorance? Or just to get through to them? I'm not going to give up my rights. But Timothy did not take that approach. It was a very powerful example of sacrificing to serve a greater cause. Paul did not walk a stumbling block. Paul talks about this in other places of the Bible too, about, you know, it. I won't eat meat if it causes my brother to offend. I won't drink wine if it causes offense. Sometimes we lay down our lives in order to be able to accomplish what God wants us to accomplish. It's called sacrifice. And sacrifice is a big part of maturity. So, as time went on, Timothy travels for a long time with Paul and Silas and Luke to a number of different areas. And eventually, it got to the point where Timothy was trusted enough by Paul that Paul sent him on his own mission. He sent him on a trip back to Thessalonica to encourage the church. Now, we have the book of 1 Thessalonians today that we often read. And that book was written as a result of Timothy reporting very encouraging news to Paul. And that prompted Paul to write 1 Thessalonians to the church. It's a very encouraging book, very helpful book. Timothy was faithful in calling out or carrying out the duties that had been given to him. And as time went on, he was given more. It's the way life is. The more we prove ourselves, the more responsibilities we gain. And over time, again, he grew very close to Paul. Here's a little known fact that sometimes we gloss over. We talk about the epistles of Paul, and it's true, Paul wrote these epistles. But they were so close that while Paul was always credited with writing his epistles, if you read them carefully, in six of the epistles of Paul, he starts off with his and Timothy's names together. Paul and Timothy. That's 2 Corinthians, Philippians, Colossians, 1 and 2 Thessalonians, and Philemon. So Paul, in writing these letters, you know, was a man had Timothy right there, and they considered themselves as a team. Now, Paul also wrote two letters to Timothy. We'll get to those a little bit later. So Timothy stayed with Paul for most of his time in Corinth and Ephesus. And then Paul sent Timothy from Ephesus back to Corinth. If you know anything about the Corinth church and the book of 1 Corinthians, you know it was a challenging, difficult church area. They had a lot of issues and a lot of problems. There was also a church area that was growing. They worked their way through a lot of these issues, and they are also an example of listening and heeding and changing and growing spiritually, and that's good. But at the time Paul wrote 1 Corinthians, he tells the Corinthian church something very interesting about Timothy. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 16. 1 Corinthians 16, the last chapter of the book, he's wrapping things up. And in verse 10, he says, "Now, if Timothy comes, see that he may be with you without fear. For he does the work of the Lord as I also do." Well, why do we say that? If Timothy comes, see that he is with you without fear. Well, there's some pretty forceful people in Corinth in some situations Paul already dealt with in the book. But it makes you wonder if maybe Timothy wasn't himself with that personality. He might not have been a forceful type of person. And it seems like Paul was a little bit worried about his presence and maybe being intimidated. Maybe because he was younger, too, would he be disrespected. And back in verse 11, he says, "Therefore, let no one despise him." Let no one despise him. The word despise means set at nothing, or at least esteem. We'll come to something just in a moment about that. Paul was defensive of Timothy, but he might have recognized that, well, Timothy may not have the personality that I do. Timothy may be a little more mild-mannered. Maybe Timothy was known as being tender-hearted, compassionate. There's nothing wrong with that. It's actually a good thing. It's a good characteristic. But he did not want the Corinthians to take that as a weakness, because Timothy was not a weak person. Let's follow up on this idea in 2 Timothy chapter 1. 2 Timothy 1. Verse 6. Paul's writing to Timothy. And he said, "Therefore I remind you to stir up the gift of God which is in you through the laying on of my hands. For God has not given us a spirit of fear." Why do we say that to Timothy? There are a whole lot of other qualities we could write in there, but Paul told Timothy, stir up the gift of God. The Spirit of God is not one of fear, but it's of power and of love and of a sound mind. Therefore, do not be ashamed of the testimony of our Lord, nor of me, his prisoner, but share with me in the sufferings for the gospel according to the power of God. There's a lot being said here. You might ask, why did Paul write this? Again, was Timothy maybe, by his nature, by his personality, maybe he had a little more timid of a person, naturally? Might he at times have been a little concerned about what people thought in terms of negative? You know, that's not uncommon. That's not uncommon for young people. I remember, at times as a teenager, being challenged by things, being so different because of beliefs, and being publicly challenged in school. I went to Donner High School in Houston, and one-third of the school was Jewish. We lived right in the Jewish community. Out of 30 kids in our homeroom, 11 were Jewish. And I got up one day after Holy Day, went up to get my excused absence. Teachers just had a stack of excused absence forms there for everybody. And a Jewish girl comes up to me in front of everybody and says, "You're lying, you're not Jewish. Where were you yesterday? Why are you trying to pretend you're Jewish? Just get out of going to school?" And we had this confrontation. And I go beet red. It's just not, where's this coming from? And, she tried to humiliate. And, you're going to face situations at times when people challenge you on beliefs of being different, or the way you are, and things you will do or things that you won't do. And it takes a bit of grit. And you learn that. You learn that over time. You practice it over time. You learn to rely on God and not be ashamed of things. So I don't know what Paul was saying exactly was going on with Timothy, but I can see that it's not an uncommon thing. And in the process of developing your own identity as an adult, as you grow into maturity and you're moving from, this is not my mom and dad's belief anymore. This is my belief, and how am I going to deal with it, and how am I going to have the strength to deal with this? These are things that you grow in finding your identity. But it's very important to realize that God doesn't just use people who are extroverts and really confident in everything from the beginning and big personalities. Sometimes we need encouragement, like Timothy did. And Paul encouraged him to keep his eyes on the right source of inner strength. And he was going to need it. When Paul wrote this, was around 66 to 67 AD. Paul's in prison. In 64, just a couple years previously, Nero had burned sections of Rome and blamed it on the Christians. The Jewish wars had started in 66, and persecution was going full force on the church. This was not an easy time. It wasn't an easy time. There have been times in my 60-plus years in the church when things were better and easier, and times when things were not easy. That's life. Life doesn't always offer easy times. There can be unsettledness in your in personal things you go through, or there can be unsettledness in the whole world. That can be, you know, upsetting, scary. You never know what's going to come up. Paul knew this and encouraged Timothy. In chapter 2, he said, "You therefore, my son, be strong. Be strong in the grace that is in Christ Jesus. And the things that you have heard from me among many witnesses, commit these to faithful men who will be able to teach others also." Now, we've used this scripture a lot in our focus mentoring and in our international leadership program, that, you know, we want to develop tiers of passing on the truth of God. What this tells us, you know, you're part of a chain. We're part of a chain in the church that began when Christ established this church. And things that we hear, we commit these to other people who will be faithful to pass it on, and they pass it on to others, and it gets handed down, the truths of God get handed down from generation to generation. Now that may be true in terms of the teachings of the church, and it is true there, but it's also true among friends. It can be true among families that, hey, you've heard things among faithful witnesses. They're true, and be faithful and teach others. Teaching others can come by giving a class, and it can also come by setting an example. It can come by setting examples, but it's important because somewhere in there, what you are will impact other people as well. Verse 3, "You therefore must endure hardship as a good soldier of Jesus Christ." Now, Timothy received this letter. It's in the Bible for us, but at some point he was the first one to get it. And he's reading this letter that Paul's written to him from prison. I would suspect he read it over and over. Kept it with him, probably. Now I wonder if Timothy ever thought, when he read these things, yes, these are things that I need to be. And these are things that he was encouraged to be. And maybe he didn't think of it this way, but in essence, these are things that you want to have said of you, aren't they? These are things you would like to have said of you, either when you're gone or when you're present. It's nice to have people say, okay, he was strong. He was strong. He went through a hard time. He stood strong in his beliefs. He was faithful. He taught me. He was a good soldier. I've thought before, what a good epitaph to have on one's tombstone. He was a good soldier. Just want to be a good soldier for Jesus Christ, to do what God wants us to do. It's important. I remember just thinking something across my mind. I'll go ahead and talk about it. I remember when I was 16 or 17, there were several of us at a Pizza Hut. I think Dave and Pinchard were with me. There were several. And there was a placemat on this at the table. And they had a lot of sayings written on it. Just things I started reading. And there was one that I saw that I cut out. I saved that placemat. I had it for years. And I lost it, but it didn't matter because I had the saying memorized. And it said on there, "Never be afraid to stand with the minority when the minority is right. Because someday, the minority that is right will be the majority." And at that time, I thought, that's the church. That's God's way of life. The church is a minority now. And we read these things, like he told Timothy here. And never be afraid to stand with the minority. Because someday that minority, God's minority, is going to be in the majority. And that's where you're going to end up, and that's where you want to be. Well, as time went on, Paul gave Timothy responsible tasks to do. In 1 Timothy 1:3, he gave him the task of being the leader of the church at Ephesus. Now, that's a church that was very special to Paul. And a central part of Timothy's work was to uphold and protect the church from false teachings. It's one of the things he told him. That'd be a good thing to have said of you, wouldn't it? He protected us from false teaching. He protected the truth. Let's see something else. Chapter 4 of 2 Timothy. Chapter 4, verse 9. Paul wrote to him, "Be